Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about the spice turmeric and how it could hold the key to treating Alzheimer's disease. Now, because we have a lot of people in this audience who have themselves or family members suffering from dementia or memory loss or Alzheimer's, you'll find this particularly important. Also, for those of you who have kidney problems, Roundup, the herbicide, it could be killing your kidneys. We'll tell you more on that. Learning a second language after the age of 10 boosts your brain. That's important. And the older you get, the more important it is that you learn another language. Probiotics can reduce the rate of recurrent urinary tract infections in women. I'll tell you why that's important that you have them each day. And also, for those of you who wondered, should I use chondroitin sulfate for my arthritis, osteoarthritis? The answer is, well, I'm going to let you know what the Cochrane Scientific Independent Review says about the debate. A lot of people are using it. Does it work? And a lot more on health and healing. Then we will be having a newsmaker update. We'll be inviting from Boston Ellen Cantarhoe to talk about a frightening news for New Yorkers. Giant fracking gas pipeline is underway as we speak. Guess where they're putting it? Right beside Indian Point Nuclear Power Reactor. You haven't heard about this. It's not in the news. It is breaking. This is an important story. She is an investigative journalist out of Boston. She'll be talking about this so we can do something about it. Also today, we will be doing a pushback to the pro-vaccine groups. And yesterday, Dr. Paul Offit did not debate Dr. Bark, Tony Bark, on national radio. Supposed to, canceled at the last moment. Well, I had been sending Dr. Bark an awful lot of scientific studies, including, all the different studies on Dr. Paul Offit's work and how many of the children died using his vaccines. And why wasn't this brought up in basic research on a guest on a major Pacifica program that had Offit on? Well, let's see what Dr. Suzanne Humphreys has to say about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Now, why is this important? Many people in this audience have told me that they're pro-vaccines, but they don't want dangerous vaccines. Well, that's very reasonable. That's understandable, providing that you have had independent proof that vaccines are effective, not just safe. What proof do you have that they're effective and safe in any given individual? You'll be surprised to know that after using every scientific technique to look at every single vaccine article that the establishment uses to promote the safety and effectiveness of vaccine, and hence its mandatory usage, not a single study exists to support them. Now, this just isn't me saying this, and I've spent years studying this and writing over 35 important, completely referenced articles. You can go to my website and look at them. In fact, right now we are collecting every single scientific article from the toxicological data, the immunological data, the public health data, the epidemiological data, and posting it. There are thousands to show why we shouldn't be doing this until there are safety studies done independently. So you'll hear from the woman who's probably spent more time doing research, medical doctor, Dr. Humphreys, on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. And that she will have critics. She will have people say it can't be, who've done zero research. She's done more than 5,000 hours of research. 5,000 hours. That's what she told me. And she's written on it. And so you'll hear from Dr. Humphreys. Also today, I'm going to start a four-part series of examining what's wrong And how did we get there? Two simple questions. What's the problem? Where did it come from? And what can we do about it? Well, being aware of it is the first step. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Many times I talk about the importance of curcumin. Now, curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric. And turmeric is one of the most important and popular spices in the world, not in the United States, but certainly in Southeast Asia, in China, Japan, and mostly in India. It's also widely used in Bangladesh and in Pakistan. Thousands of studies exist on it, so there's no longer any question of its safety or its efficacy. What now is being studied is, what are the potencies? Now, historically, when we were giving it at low doses, we got okay, but now at higher doses, getting phenomenal results. This is the latest study on this, and it says the following, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Quote, a new study has recently revealed that curcumin, a natural product found in the spice turmeric, may hold the key to treat Alzheimer's disease. The study indicated that a close chemical analog of curcumin has properties that make it useful as a treatment for brain disease. Dr. Wellington Fan said that it has demonstrated the ability to enter the brain, bind and destroy the beta amyloid plaques present in Alzheimer's with reduced toxicity. Accumulation and aggregation of protein fragments, known as beta amyloid, drives the irreversible loss of neurons in Alzheimer's disease. Developing small molecules to reduce this accumulation or promote its demolition was crucial, but the ability of these small molecules to cross the blood-brain barrier has been a restricting factor for drug delivery into the brain. Dr. Pham and his colleagues at Shinga University Medical Sciences in Otsutsu, Japan, developed a new strategy to deliver a molecule similar to curcumin more effectively to the brain, and it worked. So, here's my suggestion. Anyone with memory loss, dementia at any stage, or Alzheimer's at any stage should begin, and I have a whole protocol, but I'm only going to start with one item to make it simple. Curcumin at 2,000 milligrams in divided doses, meaning divided dose. Let's say if 2,000 and you did it five times a day, that'd be 400 milligrams. Or if you did it four times a day, it would be 500 milligrams. But it's very important to have it before you go to bed and when you wake up. We are trying to get people so aware of how dangerous Roundup is, but it's so commonly used on lawns and in farming. It's the number one used pesticide in the world. From Sayer G, Green Med Info, quote, a new observational study confirms the hypothesis that Roundup herbicide glyphosate is behind the mysterious global epidemic of chronic kidney disease that has taken thousands of lives. And then he goes on to talk about it. So, and there was an abstract on this. The abstract, quote, the current chronic kidney disease epidemic, the major health issue in the rice paddy farming area of Sri Lanka, has been the subject of many scientific and political debates over the last decade. Although there's no agreement among scientists about the etiology, that means the cause, of the disease, a majority of them has concluded that this is a toxic neuropathy. None of the hypotheses put forward so far could explain coherently the totality of clinical, biochemical, histopathological findings and the unique geographical distribution of the disease and its appearance in the mid-1990s. A strong association between the consumption of hard water and the occurrence of this special kidney disease has been observed, but the relationship has not been explained consistently. Here we have hypothesized the association using glyphosate, the most widely used herbicide in the disease endemic area, and its unique metal chelating properties. The possible role played by glyphosate metal complexes in this epidemic has not been given any serious consideration by investigators for the last 20 years. Furthermore, it may explain similar kidney disease epidemic observed in India and Central America. So, There you have it. The study tying in, and so I'll put it in lay language. In areas where you are planting rice, and you plant it by hand, and you stick the rice pods into the soil, and it's generally in a flooded area, but you're also spraying the herbicide, and the herbicide stays in the water, and then the people are drinking water. So it's in the air, but it's also in the water, and they have no way of filtering it, and that's what they have found. One more reason to ban it. Now, is ADHD on the rise worldwide? From the Globalization of a Disease, from Psychology Today, Dr. Marilyn Wedge, quote, in the United States, the number of children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, typically abbreviated as ADHD, has exploded since 1987. That year, the authors of the third revised edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-3, first introduced the ADHD diagnosis. It's often been called the Psychiatrist's Bible. It's the book psychiatrists use to diagnose mental health problems in children and adults. And whether or not ADHD is an actual medical condition is a question that I have discussed quite a lot in my previous blogs. To briefly summarize, my research and my clinical experience has led me to conclude that ADHD is a name for certain behaviors of children that are normal childhood behaviors or normal childhood reactions to stressful situations. Let me go back again. For all the psychologists and psychiatrists listening, we have a lot, and school teachers, quote, this is from a leading psychologist, Dr. Marilyn Wedge, in Psychology Today, quote, whether or not ADHD is an actual medical condition is a question that I have discussed. My research, my clinical experience has led me to conclude that ADHD is a name for certain behaviors of children that are normal childhood behaviors and normal childhood reactions to stressful situations. The word ADHD is much like the word unicorn. Everybody knows what the word is, but the thing names does not exist in nature. That is not to say that some children are not more active, fidgety, disruptive, impulsive, and inattentive in school than their peers. There's no doubt about that. But for the most part, these children are not suffering from a medical condition. I repeat, they are not suffering from a medical condition. Although there are a few actual medical conditions which can produce these behaviors in children. So, brain tumors can, encephalitis can. They can produce hyperactive, impulsive, and inattentive behaviors in children. But those are tiny. The doctors who authored the DSM-3 also identified certain psychosocial situations that could predispose the child to becoming hyperactive or inattentive or impulsive or fidgety. And so there we have it. A leading voice that you will not hear anywhere in the media saying, as a psychologist, as a parent, as a teacher, these are just normal behaviors. And sometimes, normal behavior, when stressed, is acting out. It's not a medical condition. It's not a brain chemical imbalance. In the film, The Drugging of Our Children, I interviewed hundreds of parents. I interviewed psychologists, psychiatrists, behavioralists. They all agreed. There is no proof whatsoever of brain chemical imbalance. It's just the normal behavior that we've now pathologized. Oh, we haven't pathologized it. The pharmaceutical industry pathologized it and then immortalized it in a series of false articles and then got their paid-for persons and their AstroTurf front groups to then try to promote the idea this was real and get your kid diagnosed and get them on drugs. So now most parents think it's completely normal to put a normal but possibly very active child. My generation, the baby boomers, we would all have been on Ritalin and diagnosed as ADD or ADHD if that diagnosis existed then, because we were all exuberant or we were all fidgety or we were all inattentive. I'd sit and stare out the window all the time. And my teachers would say, Gary, and I would turn back around and look. Why? I was inventing. I came up with all these inventions. And I would think, and I wasn't paying any attention to what they were saying, and I'd write everything down. Then when I get home, then I would study for whatever it was that they wanted me to learn. I'd have been, I'm lucky they didn't strap me down and give me electroconvulsive therapy, just because I wasn't looking always at the teacher. Also, from the University of Kent, plenty of research has shown that learning a second language can boost brain power. But a new study out just recently suggests that the effects extend to those who begin in middle childhood and older. And this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So one of the things that we should do in life is we should learn a hobby that is challenging, and we should learn a language, and we should learn how to play an instrument. And all three of those we can do over different time periods, and that would be a good thing. And also, good research out of Oregon State University shows that sulforaphane, remember, sol, S-U-L, furo, F-O-R-A, phane, P-H-A-N-E, sulforaphane, can help with cancer. It's an anti-cancer agent. And this was from Oregon State University, and it was published in the journal Oncogenesis. So where do you get sulforaphane? In cruciferous vegetables, your broccoli, broccoli sprouts, cauliflower, asparagus, kale, radishes, yeah, all great sulfur bearers, and garlic and onions are super sulfur barriers, all help with cancer. And a hot chocolate may prevent memory decline. From Medical News Today, a good article published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology says, quote, scientists at Harvard Medical School suggest drinking 2 cups of hot chocolate a day may keep the brain healthy and prevent memory decline in older people by preventing blood flow, by preserving blood flow, making it better in working areas of the brain. So that's terrific. Now, here's what I suggest to even make it even double better. Anytime you have that chocolate, hot or cold, always take some cayenne with it. Now, you can take a cayenne capsule. Start at a low heat register, like 30,000 units in a single capsule, and because that really increases microcirculation to the brain. So not only are you getting the polyphenols, which are the healing agents, in the neurovascular coupling that improve it, substantially, but now you get thinning of the blood, less likely to stroke. So if you have a cayenne in the evening before you go to bed, less likely to have your blood clot. When you get on an airplane, take cayenne, less likely to have a thrombosis. When you're out exercising, before you exercise, take your cayenne, less likely to have a heart attack because it's thinning the blood. But it's also increasing microcirculation to the brain. Put the two together and you have a really good microcirculation into the brain and prevent memory loss. So that's the latest on health and healing, except that the Cochrane group wanted to see whether or not there was an issue when it came to, does chondroitin sulfate work for arthritis? And the answer is yes. More than 500 studies now prove that chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine sulfate both work for osteoarthritis. That's it. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Oh, the shark babe has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, baby,
so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Where
I'd like to welcome all of you. We have a lot of program coming at you. We're going to hear from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys about the safety and efficacy of vaccines based upon 5,000 hours of research as a medical doctor and as a scientist and as a public health official and as a clinician. Then we're going to hear about how did we get to the mess we're in today. We're going to look at one part of it. The enormous budgets for the military-industrial complex and how, in any given year, what we give them and get nothing in return of value except massive bureaucracies and private contractors and ex-generals and admirals and colonels who have gamed the system, that could pay for the entire healthcare system in the United States. That could pay for every student in the United States' full tuition. So you have to look at what are we getting and what could we get for the same expenditures? All that's coming. Just want to take a moment to mention that I'm now almost at the end of the first week of working with a group of our listeners from our sister station, WBAI in New York. Wonderful group of people. And they are learning so much. The transformations have been remarkable. In fact, on tomorrow's program, I'm going to have a few of them on just to tell you the things that they said to the group last night during my lecture. And it's just bucolic. My lectures are in a beautiful meditation studio overlooking a lake, and it's magical. As one of the people from New York said, never seen a place that is so magical. The juicing, the foods, the constant workshops of every type, people brought in from the United States, a great staff of 20 who've come in to help. Next week, we have one more week, and if you'd like to come only as a work study, we have no room for guests, but we have room for two work study, which means that you get to study, you get to take in the classes, but you also do work throughout the day, maybe raking leaves, maybe helping serve the juices. We're wheatgrassing. We have one person, we're doing so much wheatgrassing, they had 100 trays of wheatgrass 9 inches high when we wanted to show them how it's actually done so they could take it home to it. So if you want to come, it's for the station. It's a fundraiser. The station sure could use it. It's $1,000, and there's still cheap flights. You can call this number, 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198. And you can come in on Sunday, and it's to the following Saturday. The weather is spectacular. It's wonderful, about 60 degrees at night, about 75 to 80 in the daytime. Power walking down country roads. This morning, everyone wanted to stop and take pictures or pet these tiny little calves in the pastures, and little foals, little horses with their mothers running across the beautiful rolling hills. It's just breathtaking. It is so de-stressing, so wonderful. And drinking the healing mineral waters. So anyhow, won't be doing it for a while, so hope you join in. And it's all meant to help this station. And good news is, from this retreat, we were able to intercede because the station was literally out of all money, but they hadn't paid for a lot of premiums. And we paid for all those premiums. So cost the station nothing, not a penny. Didn't have to do any work. They couldn't anyhow. This takes a tremendous amount of organization. And everybody is benefiting. So it's a win-win all the way around. Call 631-504-6198 and help this great station. Now let's go over and say hello to our newsmaker guest. She is in Boston. Ellen Cantrow. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello.
Ellen is a seasoned Boston-based investigative reporter and journalist. She's been writing and researching for 40 years. In the 1970s, she reported on women's issues for Condé Nast magazines and other publications. In 1979, she started writing for Israel and the West Bank and reported on Middle East issues until 2009 for The Village Voice and Mother Jones, among others. Currently, her primary focus has been on the hydrofracking industry. She writes for Truth Out, Tom Dispatch, Counterpunch, and Alternet, and she is the author of Moving the Mountain, Women Working for Social Change. And nice to have you with us today.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Our audience is not aware of what you're uncovering and what you're reporting today, so please share a little history of the negligence of the fossil fuel transport corporations, including those creating massive fracking gas pipelines such as Spectra Corporation and Kinder Morgan, and the history of pipeline blowouts, and why it is insane to put these along a nuclear power facility, Indian Point, where you've got 20 million people that would be adversely affected if that plant were ever to have an accidental meltdown or an explosion. So talk about how this project was even approved, and why haven't we heard of this before today?
Okay, Gary, may I sum this up for your audience?
Please.
Okay. There's a very long gas pipeline called the Algonquin. It's over 1,000 miles long, and it runs from Texas up to the Canadian border beyond Beverly, Massachusetts. For the past 4 or 5 years, its owner, which is a corporation called Spectra, has been driving to make expansions in this pipeline in order to carry fracked gas from Pennsylvania north. Now, the story that I wrote is not about pipelines per se, and it is not about fracking, but rather about a health and safety issue of enormous proportions that is represented by part of the expansion that Spectra is about to make in the Algonquin pipeline. And that portion of the expansion is a 2-mile-long, 42-inch section of pipe carrying gas at high pressures under a half a mile from the Indian Point nuclear plant, and at certain points within as little as 105 feet. 42 inches is about the outer limit for pipeline size, and 850 pounds per square inch of pressure is a very high pressure. Now, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is responsible for, among other things, approving or disapproving interstate gas pipeline projects. And on March 3rd, it approved the expansion project, which Spectra Corporation, owner of the Algonquin pipeline, calls the Algonquin the Algonquin Incremental Market Project. Clunky title. The short term is AIM. So it's part of this AIM project that is going to pass by Indian Point. Before FERC issued its final approval, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission judged this project safe. And it judged it safe on the basis of a very flawed hazard assessment, risk assessment, that was performed. It was commissioned by Spectra Corporation, and it was performed by a former employee of a prior owner of the plant. And we should go into what the flaws were later, but I'd rather, Gary, that you ask me questions and prompt me along here. I don't want to just talk at your audience.
We'll only know how significant this is if we pull back far enough and look at the full context. So how often are any pipelines that are carrying gas across the United States ruptured and what are the results? Because we've had multiples. And why should we be concerned if the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says it's safe? Aren't they the experts? And wouldn't they be concerned if this a pipeline that could rupture within 100 feet of Indian Point and cause the two reactors there to be adversely affected, wouldn't they have stopped this?
Well, let me address the first question. I have written about pipelines a number of times, and I always go to go on the internet and I write in pipeline ruptures, explosions. The cause of gas explosions is ruptures in pipelines. Pipelines don't cause the explosions themselves. They have to rupture, and the jetting gas that jets out of them then ignites. So there are countless. I can't tell you how many. Only a few include a gas explosion in East Harlem this past March. The giant of all gas explosions to date took place in San Bruno, California in September 2010. It killed 9 people and destroyed 70 homes. That was caused by a rupture. The pipeline was 30 inches, which is 12 inches in diameter, smaller than the piece of pipeline that's going to be passing by Indian Point. In 1994, in Edison, New Jersey, a pipeline ruptured, and there was an explosion that injured scores of people and forced the evacuation of over 2,000. There are
all right, let me interject. So
sure.
could we reasonably and plausibly suggest that if there were a rupture within 100 feet of Indian Point, that it could cause catastrophic reactions from Indian Point?
Well, I'll tell your audience that I hardly relied on myself for this article. My central interview. There are two central interviewees, and one is a professional engineer named Paul Blanche. He has about 50 years of experience in nuclear safety, in engineering operations, and federal safety requirements. He has security clearance for his work. He worked with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, from its inception in the early 1970s, and for utility corporations across the United States. And now I'm going to quote him. I've had over 45 years of nuclear experience and experience in safety issues. I have never seen a situation that essentially puts 20 million residents at risk, plus the entire economics of the United States, by making a large area surrounding Indian Point uninhabitable for generations. I'm not an alarmist and haven't been known as an alarmist, but the possibility of a gas line interacting with a plant could easily cause a Fukushima type of release.
All right. That said, what can we do about it?
Well, if your listeners, those of your listeners who live in New York, should go to a website called Stop the Algonquin Pipeline Extension, S as in Sam, A for Apple, P for Peter, E for Ellen, SAPE, and they can just put pipeline next to it, and they'll come up with a website that urges New York State residents and perhaps anybody else for that matter, because this would impact the entire country. To call New York State senators and representatives and urge them to do something about this. New York's two senators and a representative, a congresswoman named Nita Lowey, who is the second most senior member of the House Appropriations Committee, have, in fact, issued a petition requesting FERC to rehear this. And a coalition of grassroots groups has also issued such a petition.
Okay.
But people need to call these politicians.
This audience
what people can do most immediately.
this audience is very pro proactive on these issues, and
great.
We will. Thank you very much for your good work.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Ellen Cantereau from Boston, she just told us about something that none of us knew about. This is just exclusively breaking. So let's let our legislators know at the state level. Let's let the governor know. This is just insane. I mean insane. To put 20 million people at risk for what? Well, now it begins. Now let's see if we can't get a moratorium on that pipeline, gas line, until proper independent researchers have done their work. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go over and listen to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who, by the way, put it in context, she is probably the most educated physician in the United States on the subject of the research on vaccines. Now, I realize there's people in this community out here, in the BAI community, and the other communities who think, well, you know, vaccines are safe. Well, do you have the research? Have you done it? Have you read 5,000 articles? Can you read 5,000 articles? Do you have a scientific background? Would you know what you're reading? Would you know where to go to look for the articles that are important in the journals of toxicology and immunology? She has. Let's hear what she has to say.
I have been studying vaccines for the past 3 years of my life when it came up in my professional life. And my current opinion about vaccinations is that they have never been safe. Never has there been a safe vaccine. Never will there be a safe vaccine. And it is not possible to have a safe vaccine. The reasoning for that is that the actual process of vaccination defies the natural function of the immune system of living beings. It thwarts the immune system into a balance that's very unnatural and that leaves it susceptible to more things than just what you've maybe vaccinated supposedly for. Putting a disease matter into a body and thinking that the manner of which it's going in, i.e. usually through a muscle, through the skin, using a very unnatural thing, a needle, combined with all the chemicals and antibiotics and things that the manufacturing companies may not even know about at the time that they're being injected into a muscle, there's no possible way that that can be safe. Now, when you're bypassing the normal immune system by putting this disease matter into a muscle, you are stimulating yet another abnormal response at the site of the injection, pooling of all sorts of metals and things that call in the immune cells in this very unnatural way. And the result that these manufacturers or designers of vaccines often look for is simply an antibody, which is one small thing in the cascade of immunity that is so incredibly elegant they probably cannot appreciate, obviously don't appreciate, if calling a simple antibody, which is highly unpredictable, immunity is insanity. If indeed it is such a miraculous product, wouldn't we be noticing how miraculous it is? Are they saying that we are just too stupid to notice that this is killing people and maiming people, that we're too stupid to notice that it's miraculous? You know, I think that is a lot of the argument. We're just too stupid to notice how miraculous this is. So to protect everybody, we better, they're going to give it to us anyway. Why must such a wonderful product be forced upon people since the beginning of vaccination? If people were really seeing each other dropping dead of smallpox and they were really seeing each other being saved by a smallpox vaccine, the line would be out of town, you know, to get it. That's never been the case. The history books really show that the people that were vaccinated were among the sickest, that many children were dying after smallpox vaccinations, that they were developing terrible ulcerations, beautiful, perfect babies, you know, forced into smallpox vaccines, either dying or developing terrible, terrible diseases. And the diseases are often said, oh, that would have happened anyway. But parents who watch this happen time and again know otherwise. So those of us who actually notice the science is not backing up vaccination, those of us who notice that people are being maimed and killed by vaccinations, those of us who have experienced our own vaccine reactions are categorically thought to be mad, despite the fact that we've actually studied it. You know, none of my colleagues in the past studied vaccines, yet they still would think that the sound bites that they heard over and over and over the years about vaccines being safe and effective trumped any book knowledge that I may have attained and tried to discuss with them. It's baffling. It's like the minds have been sucked into this paradigm so deeply, and it's not just the minds of these doctors, but it's the safety net, and it's the comfort zone, and it's the rewards that they're getting as a result of all they're doing. And the rewards are not watching people get healthy. The rewards are monetary, and the rewards are power. That's it. It's money and it's power. Many of the vaccine enthusiast doctors will parrot the phrase that babies need to be vaccinated when they're young because the take rate is better for the vaccine. Parents are being told to bring their 2-month, 4-month, 6-month-old infants in to have them injected with some 24 different disease matter injections, complete with the polysorbate 80, amounts of aluminum that are absolutely unsafe with the amount of body weight they're being injected into, which, by the way, is to generate the immune response that's desired. That's what the aluminum is there for. They're being told to bring these children in, and the real reason is because they need to get them there at 1 year. They need to train the parents. So to train the parents, they're injecting these children. I mean, how sick is this? If it's only to train the parents, then why not just give them a saline injection at 2, 4, and 6 months, and let's just keep it to ourselves? Why do we have to inject disease matter that won't be effective and that will be problematic at 2, 4, and 6 months? An infant's immune system develops slowly. That's normal. It's part of the design. There are certain interleukins and TNFs, which are other kinds of immune cell secreted chemicals that fire up our immune system, that are specifically by nature blunted in a newborn. Vaccine scientists have been working on developing a way to rev those chemicals up because they think nature is flawed, because they think Mother Nature got it all wrong when designing the immune system of an infant, that Mother Nature had no idea how to create a human being that could fight off its own diseases while it was an infant and as it was growing. These immune chemicals that are not secreted at high levels for an infant are done so purposefully so that the immune system can develop slowly and, I'll say, thoughtfully, because the immune system does have a mind of its own. So it has to be able to respond correctly, react correctly, give feedback correctly. It is essentially like a mind in that sense. So why aren't these children all dying? Why are they not extremely vulnerable to disease, more so than the vaccine enthusiasts actually say they are, is because of breast milk. It's because of breast milk from a healthy mother who's eating a good diet. This is the design. You know, the design is to have these chemicals at a low level in an immature infant being supplemented by mother's milk. That's it. It's worked for a really long time. It works very well. And what that produces is an immune system that is highly competent in later years. And it puts forward an immune system that is still competent, even in a world full of bacteria, encapsulated bacteria that would require these responses in us, because the mother is able to essentially protect the baby with antibody through breast milk. So the inventors of vaccines have chosen a belief system whereby infants are all born with inadequate immune systems, and that the only way they can be saved from hepatitis B, rotavirus, etc., the infant vaccines, that the only way they can be saved from these diseases is getting vaccines into them as quickly as possible in multiple injections. So why do we need multiple injections? Well, they need multiple injections basically because these vaccines don't cause the immune response after one injection that would ultimately be desired by vaccine designers. Or maybe not, because each vaccine actually has its own charge that goes with it, the amount of money that it's worth and that is charged for the administration. So the more vaccines given, more money generated. But also, the fact of the matter is that these young babies have a blunted immune response compared to you or I. And that's one of the reasons why the aluminum is added to the vaccines, is to stimulate that immune response by pooling aluminum into the muscle and calling forth immune cells to react to it, which is an absolutely unnatural thing. So what happens when babies are given a vaccine is that this normal non-reactivity of the immune system is abolished. And the non-reactivity then becomes hyper-reactivity, and that's why we're seeing so much asthma, so much reactive airway disease, allergies to peanuts and so on and so forth, latex. It's because of these injections that these young children are getting, not only that have the disease matter in them, but that have provoked the immune system in an unnatural way, shifting the normal balance of non-reactivity into one of hyper-reactivity.
Now, that is Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. She has published extensively on this subject, and she is the go-to person. There are about 9 leading scientists and physicians who have done about the same amount of research. All of them came to the same conclusions. Could you imagine if 950,000 doctors, 6 million scientists, all did the same work, the same scholarship? Then we wouldn't be giving vaccines to anyone. We would be holding accountable all the vaccine companies. Now, to conclude our program today, a new series we're going to be doing, showing the problems and how we got there, who's responsible, and what we have to do to change things at the larger macro political social level. Please listen.
You understand what a cancer is? A voracious, wildly self-replicating rogue cell mass that feeds on and devours its host. If not identified, attacked, and eliminated, it will consume that body and destroy it. The U.S. military, with its vast, complex web of branches, agencies, and bureaucracies, is, in socio-political terms, a metastasized cancer run rampant in the American body politic. And we Americans are dying of it. Not surprising. The core purpose of armies is to kill people. Every country that has ever had one claimed it was for defense, but all history proves their function has never varied: to kill people and appropriate their wealth. The American military isn't killing us directly. It has an endless supply of other peoples to kill that way. It's killing us as all cancers kill, by eating the living tissue of our nation in its insatiable drive to perpetuate itself. An official army was created before our country was. After independence, it made major territorial thefts, slaughtering Indians and other nations' forces before splitting into factions that drowned each other in blood in civil war. That horror appalled the national psyche, but soon the reunited American military launched imperialist expansion that took Cuba and the Philippines from Spain and made it overlord of Latin America and the Caribbean. Experience showed there was no need to colonize nations to control them. Far more efficient to invade, crush resistance, install puppets, and subject them to unlimited economic exploitation. Usually token violence sufficed. The titanic push by the enormous American economic engine to win World War II resulted in the United States military becoming the most well-armed, technologically advanced war-making machine the world had ever known. War General and President Eisenhower warned that the existing military-industrial congressional complex might co-opt democratic government, subvert the rights of the people, and destroy all that made America great. He spoke truth too late. The process, under him, was already far advanced. A nation becomes an empire by choice. Once commitment is made to take the quantum leap from being part of the world community to becoming a power that dominates others by raw force, there is no turning back until finally, inevitably, the empire overextends itself and suffers dissolution or destruction. Many nations have taken that road. Athens, Rome, Spain, France, England, Germany, Japan. 20th century America took it. Before World War II, our military was a tool of state, used to police weak nations for political ends. After it, sole atomic power with the Soviet Union its only rival, it became a full partner with predatory capitalism, which by then owned the state. The shift was permanent and radical. Government no longer controlled capital. Capital controlled government. The corporate tyranny ruled, and the military, itself big business, ruled with it. The merging of business and military forces in a war machine is not new. It was the basis of Mussolini's fascism and Hitler's Nazi Reich. Schumpeter said of that deadly synthesis nearly a century ago, quote, created by the wars that required it, the machine now created the wars it required. By the end of the 20th century, the American military had made the greatest expansion of armed power and world control in history. In undeclared wars in Korea and Vietnam, in dozens of police actions, and with vast webs of security alliances and defensive partnerships, it insinuated its power into scores of nations around the world. The military and the corporate tyranny worked symbiotically. Military feeding off predatory capitalism while brutally enabling its worldwide rampage of financial and resource crime. With thousands of unilateral military actions initiated to date, the number and scale of America's violent interferences in sovereign nations has never been remotely approached by any empire in the history of the world. Your tax dollars fund 1,000 military installations in 150 countries, many the size of cities, supporting 250,000 troops. There are 260 bases in Germany, 124 in Japan, and 87 in South Korea. No reliable information exists on the number in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nor do we know how many black site foreign torture facilities, many Guantanamos you pay for. We do know, though, that the military operates 234 golf courses on your tax dollar. Thousands more Army, Air, Marine, and Naval bases, facilities, and hospitals support nearly 2 million troops in every state of the Union, each of them strenuously lobbied for by the political whores who claim to represent you. The annual military budget is over $1 trillion when lying, subterfuge, and deception are stripped away. That is over half the discretionary budget and exceeds the amount spent for Social Security or for Medicare. It is 10 times what is spent for education, 25 times that for science and technology, 30 times that for energy. It is greater than the combined budgets of all the other 196 countries in the world, and 7 times that of second-ranked China. Major General Smedley Butler, a top echelon career Marine who won 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, learned the hard way the reality of military mythology, and said in his book, War is a Racket, quote, I spent 33 years in active military service, and during that period I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. End quote. The military cancer is a gigantic con, a horrific shell game deception that has done nothing for the American people but rob us of the resources that should be used to create a sound and healthy society, while making us hated and despised around the world as vicious, greed-driven murderers. It does not defend us from anything. There is nothing we need to be defended from. That lie that we are threatened, endangered, at risk from some imaginary boogeyman is what blinds us to the diabolical evil that is destroying us. Only radical therapy can kill cancer. America's vitals are being consumed by the fatal malignancy of militarism. We must beat it now, or as a nation, we are terminal. If our will to live is strong enough, we can destroy it and thrive. If not, all that will remain of the grand American experiment to elevate the quality of the life of mankind will be the odious monstrosity that devoured it and a vast concentration camp of psychologically lobotomized zombies.
And I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame. And racism could no longer mask the reality of the occupation. These were people. These were human beings. I feel guilt anytime I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we are worse than Saddam as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt anytime I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We were told we were fighting terrorists. The real terrorist was me, and the real terrorism is this occupation.
And that was from the Classic War Films group. We'll be doing four more of these to show a light on different parts of our history and our society and those in power. We're out of time. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.
Whoa, 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 whoa.